And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
June. It's a solid month. Not too hot, not too cold. Excited to think it's summer, but not worn out yet from the heat. It's a time of great exuberance. It's like a natural celebration of life. It just is. Birds are nesting, bonds are deepening, summer storms are being born, and little whirlwinds of wonder. This is our life, and our year, and our planet, and our universe. And we've got a lot to be happy about. So we get ready to take a journey of the mind as we trace the deepest source of our beginnings with one of the world's leading evolutionary biologists, Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the greatest moments in life is sitting under a starry, starry night, looking up at the stars, and taking the time to wonder about the stars, and think how far away they are, and maybe to remember that the vast majority of stars you see are from our Milky Way galaxy, our community of stars. And then maybe you think about the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest other galaxy, which actually has 100 billion stars, just like ours. And then, well, you know, this is 2005, and we know a lot about our universe. We really do. And every so often, it's good for you to give your best shot at trying to figure out what this is, this universe, where it is, what it is, because it is. It really is. Today, you have the great good fortune to hear from one of the world's leading evolutionary biologists, someone who has pondered these questions but gone deeper than that. She spent her lifetime reaching deeper and deeper into the mystery of our beginnings and has a wonderful genius at explaining it to people like you and me. She has been featured on PBS, has contributed to the NOVA series, lectures around the world, and has written a variety of books, one of which you will be able to download absolutely free from our website. Dr. Elizabeth Satoris will be joining us following the news. But before we get to the news, I have a proclamation from President Bush that I want to share. Great Outdoors Month 2005, a proclamation by the President of the United States of America. During Great Outdoors Month, we celebrate our nation's natural heritage, reaffirming our commitment to conserve our environment and recognize the many volunteers who help maintain our natural spaces. Americans are blessed by our country's expansive landscapes, diverse wildlife, and beautiful public lands. Outdoor recreation provides an opportunity to enjoy the splendor of our nation's remarkable natural treasures and remind us of our responsibility to be good stewards of the environment. Across our great nation, Americans are taking that responsibility seriously and volunteering to help keep our natural areas beautiful for future generations. I commend these citizens for helping to protect our public lands, and I encourage all Americans to do their part. The Department of the Interior's Take Pride in America website and the USA Freedom Corps' website offer examples of ways to participate in environmental stewardship projects. We have an obligation to protect the Earth, and my administration is pursuing responsible initiatives to make our air cleaner, our water purer, and our land better protected. In doing so, we are demonstrating the important principle that environmental protection and economic prosperity are both vital parts of being good stewards in the land we call home. Through these and other efforts, we will continue to build a cleaner, safer, and healthier environment for all Americans. Now, therefore, I, George W. Bush, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim June 2005 as Great Outdoors Month. I call on all Americans to observe this month with appropriate programs and activities, and to enjoy safe outdoor recreational activities. In witness whereof, I have hereunto set my hand, this first day of June, in the year of our Lord 2005, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 229th. Signed, George W. Bush. So, we are with you, Mr. President, 100% in our desires to protect this earth, our land, our legacy, and enjoy it for our future. So now, the news. We may have gotten a bit closer to understanding the reason why the effects of climate change seem to be coming on so suddenly. It may be due to lies. Well, not directly. But the heat is on the White House to offer explanations as to why their chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality was allowed to rewrite reports over the past 3 years produced in collaboration with leading scientists, which literally changed the significance of the findings in ways which lessened the sense of consensus that climate change was happening and would have serious consequences. Philip A. Cooney was given editorial privileges on final drafts of such documents as the Strategic Plan for the United States Climate Change Science Program, and took the opportunity to rewrite the findings in ways which sidetracked the significance of the findings. Through carefully inserted words, he dramatically changed the conclusions of these governmental reports, which then influenced administrative policy, both nationally and internationally. An example would serve this story well. Listen to the way in which the word extremely changes the nature of this sentence, which did not use that word in its original form. And I quote, "The attribution of the causes of biological and ecological changes to climate change or variability is extremely difficult," unquote. What may be most frustrating to many is that over $1.8 billion was spent each year by the government to scientifically assess the significance such would have on societies, environments, and the future of life on Earth, all to be altered without a scientific basis. Cooney is not being allowed to comment on these charges as, and I quote, "We don't put Phil Cooney on the record. He's not a cleared spokesman." A number of leading congressional leaders are voicing concerns about China's impact on future oil availability and prices. Questions are being asked as to whether China's exploding needs are anticipated to be met by them through development of new sources or through removing oil from the markets through advanced purchase. And China is not willing to play, according to the strategic plans promoted by the U.S. regarding Iran, the Sudan, and other rogue nations. China seems very willing to do business with them, thus muddling up U.S. efforts to isolate them economically and thereby influence their options. Sinopec, one of China's state-run oil companies, has even gone so far as to sign deals with Cuba. The future of oil continues to be the gun to the heart of the developed and developing world. On another front, or shall I say roof, China is making big plans for a giant Olympic celebration in Beijing in 2008, and their first order is to literally clean up their act. Dubbed the largest construction project since the Great Wall, China is restructuring Beijing, moving polluted coal factories out of the city, creating massive forests, and most interestingly, planning to turn over 40 million square meters of rooftops in the ancient city into little green acres or rooftop gardens and tree-topped homes, businesses, and even skyscrapers. Led by Wang Xianmin, after considerable research and calculations, the city has determined that planting grasses on rooftops is the most efficient and cost-effective way to clean up the city's air, and it will turn it into a bit of a hanging garden as the city becomes the new international Babylon as athletes and visitors from around the world welcome the grand city back into the world. Scientists seem impressed that dolphin mothers off the western coast of Australia have adopted the practice of teaching their daughters to choose an appropriate sponge, affix it somehow to their nose, and use it as protection against spiny things as they root about along the ocean floor for food. Citing this as a new discovery, scientists state that this is one of only a few demonstrable examples of animals using tools and exhibiting culture, which therefore elevates them one step closer to man. As we will see during today's show, this habit of scientific conservatism has its root in deep, ancient cultural choices. In another area, people who see this have been heard to say, "Cool." And learning from nature to solve scientific challenges, Daimler Chrysler unveiled an experimental car which gets 84 miles per gallon on diesel, due very much to its amazing similarity to a fish. The boxfish, to be specific. Turning to nature, Daimler's biologists modeled the car's unusual, yet quite savvy design on the boxfish, which sports a unique hexagonal array of bony plates making up its skin, which, when applied to the design of the car's skin, provided 40% more structural strength, yet reduced the weight by one-third. For more on answers to our most perplexing problems derived from nature, stay tuned to a great show coming up following this news brief. And so, to keep things exciting, we say, and that's the news. And a few announcements. Now, I happen to know that there are lots of new listeners. It's exciting to see how the Wild Side News grows each month. If you are a new listener and want to receive our weekly email with each week's show details, you can go to today's show page and click on the Subscribe Me to the Newsletter and send it off, or just type subscribe in the subject line and send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. I look forward to hearing from you. So let's get started with this amazing journey into the history of our universe. Sit back and get ready to wander into a wonder field of thought.
This last weekend, I had the great joy of going to an event and heard a most amazing person. I'm so glad that I had this opportunity. This is Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, who has a PhD in evolution biology. As a futurist, she's an author and a speaker. Her work has appeared on NOVA. She's written for Horizon and NOVA TV, and she actually did her postgraduate work with the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I'm so envious of that. What a great place to go to school. And so your focus really is on the living systems, and you've studied this in ways that I think have great merit to our planet right now. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to put this in a framework. So if you were to say what it is that you feel that your message is really trying to impart to us.
Well, I would say that my main message is that we can learn from nature how to get ourselves through this critical transition period for our whole planet. And so I've been a student of living systems for decades, quite a few decades by now, and I find that there are things in our biological evolution that have kind of been precursors to what we're going through now in this process of globalization, which I see as more than win-lose economics, which we have to change, but more generally a process of moving us out of a hostile competition phase into a mature, cooperative, global family phase for our whole species.
I'm sure some people might say that sounds a little bit airy-fairy, and yet in reality it's the hard-edged truth of our future. This is hard science, and that's what one of the things that we're going to interestingly address, and that is the role of science in getting us into this position and how science may ultimately get us out of this position. You have traced life on Earth way back to its beginnings, but I'd love to know, from your scientific perspective as an evolution biologist, what it is that you've discovered.
Yes, Sydney. Well, about the airy-fairy thing of relating our social process as humans to biological evolution, let me deal with that first.
Sure.
And just say we are a natural species within a context of other species on what I call this living Earth, and we'll get into that part later about the living Earth. But I think almost anyone who believes in evolution, we are a part of evolution. And we add something new to it with our reflective minds and our social evolution, but essentially the process is a biological evolution process that's not generally acknowledged within the neo-Darwinian framework, and I'd like to talk about why I see things a little bit different from Darwin. But at the moment, basically it's that I see Darwin as having been half right, but having missed about half the picture in evolution, and that's has to do with the maturation into cooperation. But you asked me to go back to cosmology, so let me do that too. We, of course, have separate sciences of physics and biology in our Western scientific model, and biology has always been a bit of a second-class citizen, since physics has long been identified as the kind of father science, the main science. And so whatever physics says about our universe, biology has to fit itself into that model. And physics has given us a model of a non-living universe that's running down by entropy, meaning it's heading from a Big Bang to heat death in an endlessly expanding universe. Now, quite a few physicists I know are now working on unified field models, and most of those balance entropy with gravity, meaning balance radiation with gravity, I should say, because radiation is the force that's entropic, that obeys this law of entropy. And the unification problem in physics is how to unite gravity and radiation into one single model. So those people who are uniting them, in one case, physicist Nassim Haramein has a model where he calls gravity centropy, so that we have entropy balanced by centropy. Entropy being the radiation force that's infinitely outward, and that of course is what we see through our telescopes, whether they're light telescopes or radio telescopes. It's all electromagnetic radiation. And then gravity is invisible to telescopes, but we know, because we can feel and measure it, that it's a concentrating force, an inward force. So if you think of it as radiation infinitely outward and gravity infinitely inward, then you see that you can have a dynamic balance between these two forces. And gravity can also, as Haramein and Rauscher, his partner is Elizabeth Rauscher in this theory, as they call it, centropy, they're talking about, they're also naming it the generoactive force, because by pulling things together, you permit radiation to expand. The contraction and the expansion are kind of like anabolism and catabolism in physiology. You have one force building things up, the other one breaking them down and recycling them. So it's that kind of a balanced cosmology that gets us out of the socially depressing idea that everything is running down and you have to get what you can while you can, which is what we got from this one-way entropic universe. Philosophies such as existentialism, the purposelessness of the universe, the non-living universe running down, has just not been very good for us. Now, if it were true, then we'd have to accept that maybe it's not good for us. But if it turns out that this conception of the universe does not fit the current data as well as alternative conceptions, then we have to rethink it all.
What I want to do is project this into the life systems itself, and the fact that we see this as well in the living systems, the male, the female, life and death, but in particular this coming together of, well, whatever these are. They're not opposites. Male and female are not opposite. They're cooperating two sides of a whole.
Yes, it's a duality that mm-hmm. belongs together.
Mm-hmm. The fact that we do have, for example, male-female as the basis of so much of recreation, perhaps the roots of that go way back into this very primordial dynamic of our universe itself. For myself, my quest has been to really try to understand life from the perspective of the roots of life, which is this cosmological evolution. What I'm trying to get to is the way in which these forces now are manifesting in literally the living systems to show a continuity, to suggest that the forces of the universe itself and our own existence are intimately related. Mm-hmm. And we can literally draw direct logical correlations, potentially, mm-hmm. scientifically, between our existence and life and these manifestations of life, and as well the cosmological principles of expansion and contraction, of radiation and gravity, and that it gives me purpose to realize that what I am experiencing as a human, for example, on the planet, is really a manifestation of the truth of our universe. It's my own concept of a spiritual nature.
Yes, I would say so. And the problem for me with the Western scientific model is that before it ever does any research to prove anything, it has concepts about what kind of a universe we live in. And it started out with this unquestioned assumption that we live in a non-living universe. Now, interestingly, all the other cultures of our world have seen it as a living universe. The concept of a non-living universe goes back perhaps to the ancient Greeks in our European heritage, because there was that model of spheres within spheres, with holes in the spheres through which an external light shone, and that was the stars. So you can trace that idea of a non-living universe back that far. But some people confuse the idea of a non-living and a dead universe, but they're quite different, because something dead was once alive, and non-living means it never was alive, which is the physics conception of our universe. Now, because other sciences in the world, like the Arabic sciences and the Vedic science and indigenous sciences and others, did not have this concept of a non-living universe, I also decided to question it. And I ended up making a 180-degree turn, which I find many of my fellow scientists have made now, from believing that consciousness is a late emergent product of material evolution in a non-living universe, to the concept of consciousness being the very source of the material universe and everything in it. That's the Vedic or Hindu, ancient Hindu view. And they did, you know, thousands of years of research on consciousness and things like that. This was not a conclusion arrived at lightly. And the East, of course, spends as much time investigating mind internally as we in the Western science traditions spend investigating the externals, the things that are our projected universe or our outer reality, if you like. And when you put East and West together, then just as entropy and centropy, you have a balanced view of a science. And I've come to feel that whenever you see a one-way force in nature, something's wrong, look for its partner. Because the original unity of consciousness, that field we can call God or Brahman or whatever in our traditions, that has to create dualities out of its unity in order to make worlds.
Well, that's a few billion years worth of history. When we return, we continue to explore the new scientific paradigm that brings life to the forefront of how we think. When we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Ever wonder what this thin layer of life is which grips the planet, rarely rising more than 10 feet, most confined to a few inches from the surface, some life reaching at its grandest a mere 300 feet off the surface of the Earth? It's a thin line we live in, and it got here somehow. It's a big debate, no doubt, even as we speak. And science seems to be central to the question and the controversy, and perhaps even the answer. When we return, we move along ahead a few billion years more and discover the shape of life in the universe. This journey continues when we return here on the Wild Side News. What if Galileo had looked at everything differently? Would we be in the fix we are today? We continue our discussion with evolutionary biologist Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, who hand carries us farther into the mystery.
It's interesting, the Eastern and Western, that is part of the challenge these days, because the Eastern typically really has a focus on the One. The oneness, oftentimes, I mean, if people, for example, are meditating, they're thinking of oneness, the word Om is a process of trying to resonate with the One. And the Western tradition is one about me and individuation. And so those two are, all by themselves, sort of, they're different forms of being human, different approaches and views. But this is also part of our challenge right now, is trying to figure out how it is that we, because the West celebrates me.
Yes.
And the East, they focus on the oneness.
Yes.
How do we bring
that
together?
Rather than on the individuation. We in the West have taken the concept of the individual pretty far, and that's been an important process. In my universe, anything that can happen will happen, and somebody somewhere had to try out what it would be like to pretend you were separate from that oneness. And forgot, you know, that you were part of it, and how would that play out in society? And that's really what we've done. And now we find that there's this hunger for reintegrating the two paths of knowledge again to get a more complete view of things.
You made a point during your discussion that I found so enlightening, and that was the fact that the analogy that you draw is that Galileo had the opportunity to look both through a telescope and a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think this is so, I love this. And somehow the power of the celestial story, the astronomical vision of the world, overpowered what he could have focused on had he decided that the microscopic, or the living, was the main theme. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, yes. See, the heavens in Galileo's time had already been identified as celestial mechanics, and therefore it was compatible with this non-living universe story. And what I was saying was, if he had looked through those newfangled lenses of his day, inverted to make a microscope, he would have seen all those squiggly little things everybody has witnessed in that drop of pond water experiment or hay infusion experiment that you generally do in junior high school. And that was a miraculous world to study, just, and still is. That micro world is even more interesting now than it was then. And we're learning more about its unbelievable complexity. So it might have inspired Galileo to think more in terms of a universe of life, a living universe. That was what I had in mind there.
Well, and think about the changes. Had that been the main thrust of science, because both of these are science,
then physics would have had to fit itself into the biology model. And that's exactly where I've come, is that if you can make the unproven assumption that this is a non-living universe, and then do research within that framework and see how far you get, you can just as validly make the fundamental assumption, and make it explicitly so that you're not hiding this, that you're working with a living universe, one that starts in consciousness, something none of us humans have ever been out of. So in some sense, it must be fundamental in our models. And then go from there and see, how do we reinterpret the data of all the research of science within that framework? Does it lead to better explanations of who we are and where we're headed? And I find that in my experience, it does work better to make that assumption.
If we had spent the last 2,000 years focused from that perspective, what a different world the West would...
Yes, the problem with Western science is that you go to graduate school and you learn these unproven assumptions, these fundamentals in the model, but then people forget and they assume that of course this is a non-living universe, that's just the way things are. They don't realize that that is a belief that was set at the base of science. And let me just say that, you know, Descartes, who is one of the founding fathers of science, had a model of the universe in which God was the grand engineer who invented the machinery of nature. And then he put a piece of God mind into man, his favorite robot, so that man too could create machinery. Now, that was a logically complete system because machinery, if you look in a dictionary, requires an inventor. But scientists eventually decided that they had no need for this hypothesis of God, and then continued to explain nature as machinery, which became completely illogical because you can't have machinery without an inventor, without any purpose. And science claims that there's no purpose and no inventor for the machinery of nature. So that's actually an illogical position.
As a scientist, I'm trained as a biologist. I have had experiences that lead me to understand, for example, that I can communicate with animals, that animals have a consciousness, they have an awareness, they have feelings, that they're way more complex than science allows us to even think. I mean, for example, I think the first commandment of science is thou shalt not anthropomorphize. Yeah.
No, but interestingly, you are expected to mechanomorphize. In other words, you have to see nature as mechanics in graduate school as a biologist, right?
Exactly.
And
the point,
I used to say, hey, mechanomorphism is secondhand anthropomorphism. Why not at least go directly to, I read a wonderful essay once with the statement in it that said it takes a living system to know a living system. So anthropomorphizing may not be all bad if you want to identify with life.
Let's have a little bit of fun for a moment here, and now let's go through the other system, because you have also really tracked the miraculous universe of the microscopic, and you're able to describe that miraculous nature in ways that I think are so profound. Share some of that, the concept of what's involved in even one living cell and how that cell then starts to relate to a more holistic vision of life and the earth and our place in that.
Yes, well, if I go for a minute back to the idea of the balance between entropy and syntropy, or syntropy biologically, a planet's surface is really, as the ancients intuited, halfway between the microcosm and the macrocosm. That's now measurable. That's an established fact in science. And the way I see it, the entire universe is in the process of creating living systems at all levels, from particles and atoms at the small size level to superclusters of galaxies at the larger level up to the universe. And with the entropy-centropy concept, you find that actually there are only two cosmic forces, because the strong and weak nuclear forces are accounted for mathematically by gravity at the level of the atom, and there's no need for dark matter or energy to be postulated. Again, this is the theory of Nassim Haramein and Elizabeth Rauscher, whom perhaps you'll be able to interview sometime.
Great.
And in that system, I use the definition of life, which we've had now for about 30 years, from two Chilean-born biologists named Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. They were at MIT and the University of Paris, respectively. And that life definition is autopoiesis. It's the only core definition of life in biology. Usually people are just taught lists of attributes of living systems. Now, that definition is, autopoiesis is a Greek word meaning self-creation. And the definition of life, then, is any living entity is one that continually creates and maintains itself in an environment of some kind. So I thought about what would be the simplest thing that continually creates itself in relation to its environment, and I came up with a whirlpool. Because a whirlpool in a river keeps bringing new matter energy, the water, the flowing water, into itself and lets that water out through the bottom, the tip of the vortex, and holds its form through that continual exchange of matter, which is exactly what you and I do as physical bodies. We take in food, water, and air. We continually recreate ourselves from the particle and atom level up to the molecular and cell level, and we hold that form recognizably as we do so. So you see a connection between those two forms. Also, if you take the bottom of a vortex and connect it back to the top, and then flip it around into three dimensions, you get a donut shape, or a toroid. In mathematics, it's called a torus, a toroidal form. So a toroidal form is a vortex connected at top and bottom so that it can independently exist in space. Now, you and I are both toroids because we have one hole starting with our mouths that goes right through the middle of us. And if you know anything about the math called topology, you'll know immediately that that means our whole body is equivalent topologically to a donut-shaped torus. So all this led me to think, perhaps in this universe where you have infinitely outward entropy and infinitely inward centropy, halfway between the microcosm and the macrocosm on planets, you will find the forces of creation moving both upward and downward colliding at this mid-level of the universe, and there forming the extra complexity we know as biological life. Mm. So this is my theory, that biological entities are nothing more nor less than a special case of the self-creation of living systems at all levels of our universe. That was a bit long, but I had to do that to get this out.
Well, I appreciate that. As I'm sure everybody is aware, this is an amazing discussion with an amazing person. I wish that we could go on for about 4 hours. We'll continue, but there's so much to this. And by the way, at this point, why don't you go ahead and give a website where people can learn more about your work, and okay, then we'll continue.
I have two websites. One is www.saturis.com, and that's spelled S-A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S, saturis.com. And that's kind of a business brochure with some links to articles, but most of my writings are on another website, which is www.radical, like radical with a T, RATICAL.org/lifeweb, LIFEWEB.
And of course, those links are on the website.
Yes, and there's a whole copy of my book Earth Dance at that latter website, as well as about 20 or 30 articles. They're all free for the download.
Yes, which is a terrific gift to anyone who's listening. You can go there and literally download a 232-page book, Earth Dance, that Elizabeth Satoris has written, and it's yours as a gift. So it is truly a gift. Following on some of this concept, and one of the things that I've always been intrigued with as well, and I love the concepts of spirals. People talk about waves, for example, and they draw them on a chalkboard, these undulating lines. But from my perspective, a wave really is a cross-section of a spiral, that if you were to take a spiral and do a cross-section, that's what you'd see. And suddenly when you start to see waves or interpret them as spirals, then all of a sudden everything starts to make sense.
Yes.
When we talk about waves, because then they have energy, they have direction, they have form, they have power, and can take literally form and dimension. That manifestation in nature itself, for example, if we look at the DNA, just as one prime example of a couple of intertwining spirals that counter-reflect one another in many wonderful ways, that also is a manifestation of these of the duality of our nature in form. And I want to lead that to something else, but I'd just be curious of your comments about even DNA and its place in this story.
Well, I certainly agree with you that the spiraling form, you know, that that's the basic wave nature of the universe. If you think about, you know, our planet, it's not really rotating around the sun in circles because the sun is moving in spirals around in the galaxy, and then our Earth is following it around. So if you traced out the actual path of our Earth, it would be very complex spirals within spirals within spirals.
Exactly right, yeah.
Depending on whether you're looking at the Earth or the sun or the galaxy, all of which are linked. You know, the old concept of it's turtles all the way down in the creation story of the Indians, who said the Earth is on a turtle's back, and where is the turtle? It's on another turtle's back, right? Well, spirals all the way down and all the way up in our universe.
One of the things I'm intrigued with when you talk about this concept, it's almost as if consciousness somehow is interwoven in this entire matrix.
Well, I think consciousness is the matrix.
Well, we're making the same point.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find so amazing in terms of the miraculous nature of life itself, and that is that no matter how complex our life becomes, somehow within this ancient DNA that was formed, you know, the basis of a human existence was formed millions of years ago.
Yes.
So we see some sort of evolutionary process.
Billions, actually.
Well, I'm trying to be conservative, okay? But you're right. That within that DNA matrix was the power to envision beyond reality. That's one of the things that I just find is extraordinary. That there was some sort of survival advantage, some selective force for life that could literally see things that weren't. We look at our world today and we're still inventing new concepts, new things, new ideas. Even as we're talking, we're creating things that never existed before.
Yes.
And that built into our DNA as some sort of ancient system of survival was this capacity to see or envision or visualize answers to questions that were beyond our current realms.
I'm not exactly clear on how to talk about that in DNA separate from the proteins. Once again, we have a duality in nature. DNA by itself can't do anything. It's a crystalline substance, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And proteins are what unlock DNA as needed. So I've come to see DNA, which is housed in the nucleus of each of our 100 billion cells, as the library of information that proteins can draw on in building living systems. And it still isn't known how much of what goes on in our biology is due to the information in the DNA and what's due to the intelligence in the protein itself. So it's very hard to separate those two. But together, they certainly are building living entities which have a new kind of mind in evolution, this self-reflexive mind that, for example, invents a linear time sequence out of a nonlinear reality, so that we can function with memory of past and projection into future. And that's a wonderful new experiment on the part of nature, apparently, and we don't quite know what the results of that experiment are going to be. For example, I assumed, because we can project into the future, that we would be able to foresee where we're headed in the evolutionary trajectory and avoid some disasters, while the other species in nature have generally been pushed to evolve by disaster. But I have to say, Sydney, that the older I get and the more experience I have of my own species, the more it looks to me like we are being pushed by the crises we invent, just as other species have been pushed into evolution by crises.
You know, I think this would be a great point to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come back, I'd like to now explore how it is that these principles may be able to help us resolve our future in a better, more holistic, and sustainable way.
Okay.
So we are the stuff of the universe, and our thoughts and visions are like the movie screens of God, or perhaps they are just randomized ramblings of the atoms which interpenetrate them all. We interpenetrate our place on this earth and the cosmic dance, and what this may all mean to our future as oil prices hold guns to our dreams, and changes wrought by our great science and intellect solid the vision of an endless carefree summer and beyond when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're running out of time to get this all figured out, both on today's show, and according to some, in our global dream of a world economy in exchange and goods and stuff unlimited. So when we return, we move quickly into the future and find out what nature tells us about life on Earth. Wait, nature is life on Earth, and, well, we are nature as well. Maybe it's time we realign our visions of what we are and where we are in our own evolution of existence. So hang on as we continue with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. Can nature reach up and talk to us? Or do we reach inward to talk with our nature? We try to find out as we continue our discussions with Dr. Elizabeth Satoris.
You know, what I have discovered in looking at evolution and in questioning the Darwinian theory, where is it right, where does it not go far enough, I came to two concepts that really helped me to understand the evolutionary process. One of them is a very simple concept that comes from Arthur Koestler, the philosopher, and for those listeners who have read Ken Wilber, you'll know that he also adopted this idea of holons and holarchy, where a holon is just any living entity, and holarchy is that living entity's embeddedness within other levels. For example, the holarchy of your body would be molecules within cells, within organ systems, within the whole body, or an individual within a family, within a community, within an ecosystem, within a nation, within a world. This is a very important and very useful concept that living systems are always embedded within other living systems. So let's think holons and holarchy. And then the other concept is one of a maturation cycle in evolution, which is kind of like the maturation cycle that we go through as individuals, where we first, there's a unity of mother and baby, and then you individuate from the mother, and you go through childhood and into a kind of feisty, competitive adolescence, and eventually we learn to cooperate with each other as mature adults, at least we hope so, and that makes life work for us as social creatures. Now, the way I see this in nature is that young, immature species are the kind of species ecologists say populate type 1 ecosystems. They take as much territory as they can get, they reproduce as fast as possible, and therefore use up as many resources as possible to establish and perpetuate themselves. They're very competitive in this process if they meet other species. Now, that's the part Darwin told us about. However, if they don't kill each other off at that stage, I believe they go on into a mature cooperative phase which is what ecologists will tell you the species are like in a type 3 ecosystem. They ensure the life of other species by contributing something to them. They're very cooperative in their sharing of resources and territory. These are ecosystems like rainforests and prairies, very well-evolved ecosystems. Now, interestingly, while ecologists talk about these type 1 and type 3 ecosystems, and they'll tell you type 2s are transitional, with perhaps some of each of those kinds of species in them, they do not see this as a maturation cycle. But I asked myself, where do those cooperative species come from? They didn't seem to be there to start with. There's something about these two ways of behaving that we humans can anthropomorphize about and identify as being our own phases of maturation. And when you see things that way, you understand why in nature you can point to both cooperation and competition and see them in a unified theory. You know, Darwin knew there was cooperation going on in nature, but the unification theory is seeing it as a maturation cycle. Now, once you see that, then you can go back through evolution and say, okay, how did this play itself out in some of the important evolutionary events? And to me, the most important one is the invention of the nucleated cell. There are only two kinds of cells on this planet. There are bacterial cells, which occupied the Earth for half of its life with no other kind of cell around. And then somewhere around the middle of Earth's life, the bacteria formed nucleated cells, thousands of times bigger than bacteria, as colonies. Now, originally, in their hostile competitive mode, the bacteria were very like us humans in colonizing each other, different kinds of bacteria, so that high-tech fast bacteria would drill into low-tech sluggish bacteria and literally consume their molecules from the inside in a very colonial kind of process. But somewhere along the way, the bacteria, which had diversified into a number of different lifestyles, discovered that feeding each other was economically more efficient and better for everybody concerned than the hostile competition. And so they formed huge communities, and each gave up some of their DNA to this central library I call the nucleus, and we had a second kind of cell on the planet, a nucleated cell. And everything else that evolved after that is made of these nucleated cells. It never had to be redesigned again after that invention. So there was the maturation process. You had the bacteria individuating from a uniform Earth's crust, and then you had them going through the juvenile phase of the competition that got pretty hostile sometimes, and they developed a lot of technologies in the process, including things we've invented. I call their invention of the first World Wide Web their exchange of DNA among each other. And to this day, all bacteria can trade DNA with each other on this planet. And they invented photosynthesis, meaning they harnessed solar energy. When they had eaten up all the free food, they harnessed solar energy and made their own food out of what was left, which was minerals, sunlight, and water. And then they went on to invent nuclear piles, probably to keep warm. And they invented the electric motor, which is of great interest now to the nanotechnologists. That's what made some of them high-tech bacteria. So it's just fascinating to see how much we are repeating things that were learned at the micro level about 2 billion years ago. And that's it now. We've got the concept of holarchy and the concept of the maturation cycle. And then there's something else very interesting about that. When you put those two concepts together, you see something very interesting. Think of the holarchy of your body, which I described as cells within organ systems within the whole body. And now imagine that that cycle is being continually played out in the eternal now, because every level of holarchy in your body has to be able to express its self-interest in order to function. And that means that there are some conflicts that develop among the different levels, so that you have to have constant negotiations going on between, say, an organ and its component cells, so that the organ can meet its self-interest and the individual cells can meet their self-interest. So that dynamic goes on and pushes cooperation. Somehow the system knows that everything in it has to be healthy for the system as a whole to be healthy. And that body wisdom, as it used to be called by physiologists, is something we need in the holarchy that goes through individual, family, community, ecosystem, world, because it immediately tells you that your world economy can only be healthy if what's at the top, which is presently the World Trade Organization, recognizes the need to negotiate with and ensure the self-interest of every local economy in that system. Do you see how the two things connect together?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So we have tools with this maturation cycle and the concept of holarchy to see exactly what works well in our world and what doesn't.
This kind of comes back to that East-West duality in the sense that what we're witnessing here, because no one talks about an Easternization process in terms of globalization, they talk about a Westernization process, which is actually sort of taking this concept of individualistic capitalism out to the point where virtually anybody who has the right enough money and power is able to dominate and control and take from other systems. Yeah. And this is the beginning of what you're talking about in terms of how do we then apply a more equitable.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bingo.
Yeah, we're thinking alike here.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The Soviet East tried to build a system on sacrificing individual interest to community self-interest or community interest. And the West was doing the opposite. It was sacrificing community to individual interest. So they both had half a system. The Soviet Union collapsed because it wasn't meeting self-interest, and human beings don't function very well if they can't meet their self-interest any more than the cells within them could function if they couldn't meet their self-interest. But you also get a system into trouble if you're sacrificing community self-interest. That would be like in the body, it's like a cancer where the individual cells meet their self-interest but do not any longer negotiate with the other levels of holarchy and therefore care only about their self-interest and not about the self-interest of the organ systems or the body. Mm-hmm. And so that's a dead end too.
Life stops at that point.
Life stops at
or
that
it gets
point.
Very,
you
very miserable.
You destroy your own ecosystem, then you can't live. If the cells destroy their body, then they can't live.
Well, you've go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that if we relate this to economics, it all becomes very clear that just as in a rainforest, species have discovered the cost effectiveness of ensuring the life of their fellow species. Think of our world and how much better we would get along if we recognized that a tiny fraction of the Pentagon budget spent on developing those enemy countries would make friends of those people and give us markets.
Yes.
You know, it's just, to me, an insanity that you would spend huge amounts of wealth on destroying other cultures, other countries, than to make friends of them by developing them, which is what we're in the process of learning now.
There's so many ways in which nature can serve as a guide. For example, I like to think oftentimes about a forest and the fact that in a forest there are the grand trees, the grand old large trees that live and tower and dominate. But when they die, they fall, and then all that they were is redistributed back into that community. And without that system, in other words, if all trees that grew were to grow up and then be turned into stone, pretty soon there would be no more forest.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a very simple concept that perhaps, I mean, I'm just sort of free associating here, but perhaps one of the unnatural systems is the accumulation of wealth in ever more smaller groups of people. That could be something that just plain does not serve this living system very well.
No, it doesn't. And, of course, Arnold Toynbee, who investigated the demise of 23 previous civilizations, found two common features in that demise, one of which was the extreme concentration of wealth, and the other was a failure to change when change was really called for, you know, rigidity in societies. What I like to say about the distribution of wealth is that the economics we're playing out in the world today is really like a monopoly game. A monopoly game is about concentrating wealth in the hands of one of the players, right? And when you finish playing Monopoly, what do? You either redistribute the wealth or you go play something else. And I suggest we play something else in our world Monopoly game.
We just have a couple of minutes left. What are some of the games that you see as new games that may work?
Well, it's really, if you think in game theory, about moving to win-win games rather than win-lose games. And there are ways for everybody to win, and we can see that from this history of evolution. If we update the Darwinian theory to seeing the way species in nature learn to cooperate with each other in win-win situations, that's all we need to know to see how to build global family in our world.
Well, we could carry this conversation. We've barely touched the surface, but Elizabeth Satoris has many things to do, and I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being adding your voice to the Wild Side News, and I look forward to communicating with you and keeping in touch.
You're more than welcome, Sydney.
Why don't you go ahead and give your website one more time, and also just what are your plans into the future? Where might people be able to find you, and what are some of your dreams?
Okay, well, I'm traveling around the world a lot, and I consult with some companies, and I teach in a sustainable business MBA program that people can find information about at the website of the Bainbridge Graduate Institute. If you just Google that, you'll find it. And my websites, again, are saturis.com, saturis.com, and Ratical, RATICAL.org/LifeWeb. So I'm continuing to write, to lecture around the world, to consult with businesses that want to become more like living systems and live in Southern California, and I'm having a wonderful life.
Thank you so much for sharing all that you are with my people and the world.
Thank you, Sydney.
So now you have a clear signal to put nature first, to attune yourself to your own observations of your world, your feelings, your nature, and the grand and amazing moment we share on our swirling, swirling little Earth. By the time we meet again, little planet Earth will have spun itself into circles 7 times, which is about halfway through its annual journey around the sun, which too is swirling in a finger of the Milky Way, out amongst the family of galaxies that make up our little neighborhood in the hundreds of billions of galaxies that we use to imagine a limit that is limitless, or perhaps not, but then will we ever know really what this is all about? Now, go on out and live. This is Sydney Wildsmith, your host and producer of the Wild Side News, wishing you all a great helping of life until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives on your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News.